Death on the Nile. Lady Grail was nervous. From the moment of coming on board the SS Fayum, she complained of everything. She did not like her cabin. She could bear the morning sun, but not the afternoon sun. Pamela Grail, her niece, obligingly gave up her cabin on the other side. Lady Grail accepted it grudgingly. She snapped at Miss McNaughton, her nurse, for having given her the wrong scarf, and for having packed her little pillow instead of leaving it out. She snapped at her husband, Sir George, for having just brought her the wrong string of beads. It was lapis she wanted, not carnelian. George was a fool. Sir George said anxiously, "Sorry, my dear, sorry. I'll go back and change 'em. Plenty of time." She did not snap at Basil West, her husband's private secretary, because nobody ever snapped at Basil. His smile disarmed you before you began. But the worst of it fell assuredly to the dragoman, an imposing and richly dressed personage whom nothing could disturb. When Lady Grail caught sight of a stranger in a basket chair and realized that he was a fellow passenger, the vials of her wrath were poured out like water. "They told me distinctly at the office that we were the only passengers. It was the end of the season. There was no one else going." "That right, lady," said Mohammed calmly. "Just you and party, and one gentleman, that's all."
"But I was told there would be only ourselves."
"That quite right, lady."
"It is not all right. It was a lie. What is that man doing here?"
"He come later, lady. After you take tickets. He only decide to come this morning."
"It's an absolute swindle."
"That's all right, lady. Him very quiet gentleman. Very nice, very quiet."
"You're a fool. You know nothing about it. Miss McNaughton, where are you?" "Oh, there you are. I've repeatedly asked you to stay near me. I might feel faint. Help me to my cabin and give me an aspirin, and don't let Mohammed come near me. He keeps on saying, 'That's right, lady,' till I feel I could scream."
Miss McNaughton proffered an arm without a word. She was a tall woman of about 35, handsome in a quiet, dark way. She settled Lady Grail in the cabin, propped her up with cushions, administered an aspirin, and listened to the flow of complaint. Lady Grail was 48. She had suffered, since she was 16, from the complaint of having too much money. She had married that impoverished baronet, Sir George Grail, 10 years before. She was a big woman, not bad-looking as regarded features, but her face was fretful and lined, and the lavish makeup she applied only accentuated the blemishes of time and temper. Her hair had been in turn platinum blonde and henna red, and was looking tired in consequence. She was overdressed, and wore too much jewellery.
"Tell Sir George," she finished,
while the silent Miss McNaughton waited with an expressionless face,
"tell Sir George that he must get that man off the boat. I must have privacy. All I've gone through lately."
She shut her eyes.
"Yes, Lady Grail," said Miss McNaughton,
and left the cabin. The offending last-minute passenger was still sitting in the deck chair. He had his back to Luxor and was staring out across the Nile to where the distant hills showed golden above a line of dark green. Miss McNaughton gave him a swift, appraising glance as she passed. She found Sir George in the lounge. He was holding a string of beads in his hand and looking at it doubtfully.
"Tell me, Miss McNaughton, do you think these will be all right?"
Miss McNaughton gave a swift glance at the lapis.
"Very nice indeed," she said. "You think Lady Grail will be pleased, eh?"
"Oh, no, I shouldn't say that, Sir George. You see, nothing would please her. That's the real truth of it. Oh, by the way, she sent me with a message to you. She wants you to get rid of this extra passenger." Sir George's jaw dropped.
"How can I? What could I say to the fellow?"
"Well, of course you can't." Elsie McNaughton's voice was brisk and kindly. "Just say there was nothing to be done." She added encouragingly, "It will be all right."
You think it will, eh?"
His face was ludicrously pathetic. Elsie McNaughton's voice was still kinder as she said, "You really must not take these things to heart, Sir George. It's just health, you know. Don't take it seriously."
"You think she's really bad, nurse?"
A shadow crossed the nurse's face. There was something odd in her voice as she answered,
Yes, I don't quite like her condition, but please, don't worry, Sir George. You mustn't. You really mustn't. She gave him a friendly smile and went out. Pamela came in, very languid and cool in her white.
Hello, Nunks.
Oh, hello, Pam, my dear.
What have you got there? Oh, nice.
Well, I'm glad you think so. Do you think your aunt will think so too?
She's incapable of liking anything. I can't think why you married the woman, Nunks. Sir George was silent. A confused panorama of unsuccessful racing, pressing creditors, and a handsome, if domineering, woman rose before his mental vision.
Poor old dear, said Pamela. I suppose you had to do it, but she does give us both rather hell, doesn't she?
Since she's been ill, began Sir George.
Pamela interrupted him.
She's not ill.
Not really. She can always do anything she wants to. Why, while you were up at Assouan, she was merry as a cricket. I bet you Miss McNaughton knows she's a fraud.
I don't know what we'd do without Miss McNaughton, said Sir George with a sigh.
She's an efficient creature, admitted Pamela. I don't exactly dote on her as you do, though, Nunks.
Oh, you do? Don't contradict. You think she's wonderful.
So she is, in a way, but she's a dark horse. I never know what she's thinking. Still, she manages the old cat quite well.
Oh, look here, Pam. You mustn't speak of your aunt like that. Dash it all, she's very good to you.
Yes, she pays all our bills, doesn't she? It's a hell of a life, though.
Sir George passed on to a less painful subject.
What are we to do about this fellow who's coming on the trip? Your aunt wants the boat to herself.
Well, she can't have it, said Pamela coolly. The man's quite presentable. His name's Parker Pine. I should think he was a civil servant out of the records department, if there is such a thing. Funny thing is, I seem to have heard that name somewhere.
Basil?
The secretary had just entered.
Where have I seen the name Parker Pine?
Front page of the Times Agony column, replied the young man promptly. Are you happy? If not, consult Mr. Parker Pine.
Never. How frightfully amusing. Let's tell him all our troubles, all the way to Cairo.
I haven't any, said Basil West simply. We're going to glide down the Golden Nile and see temples.
He looked quickly at Sir George, who had picked up a paper. Together. The last word was only just breathed, but Pamela caught it. Her eyes met his.
You're right, Basil, she said lightly. It's good to be alive.
Sir George got up and went out. Pamela's face clouded over. What's the matter, my sweet?
My detested aunt by marriage.
Don't worry, said Basil quickly. What does it matter what she gets into her head?
Don't contradict her.
You see, he laughed, it's good camouflage.
The benevolent figure of Mr. Parker Pine entered the lounge. Behind him came the picturesque figure of Mohammed, prepared to say his piece.
Lady gentlemen, we start now. In a few minutes we pass temples of Karnak, right-hand side. I tell you a story now about little boy who went to buy a roasted lamb for his father.
Mr. Parker Pine mopped his forehead. He had just returned from a visit to the temple of Dendera. Riding on a donkey was, he felt, an exercise ill-suited to his figure. He was proceeding to remove his collar when a note propped up on the dressing table caught his attention. He opened it. It ran as follows. Dear Sir, I should be obliged if you should not visit the Temple of Abydos, but would remain on the boat, as I wish to consult you. Yours truly, Ariadne Grail. A smile creased Mr. Parker Pine's large, bland face. He reached for a sheet of paper and unscrewed his fountain pen. Dear Lady Grail, he wrote, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I am at present on holiday and am not doing any professional business. He signed his name and dispatched the letter by a steward. As he completed his change of toilet, another note was brought to him. Dear Mr. Parker Pine, I appreciate the fact that you are on holiday, but I am prepared to pay a fee of £100 for a consultation. Yours truly, Ariadne Grail.
Mr. Parker Pine's eyebrows rose. He tapped his teeth thoughtfully with his fountain pen. He wanted to see Abydos, but £100 was £100, and Egypt had been even more wickedly expensive than he had imagined. "Dear Lady Grail," he wrote, "I shall not visit the Temple of Abydos. Yours faithfully, J. Parker Pine." Mr. Parker Pine's refusal to leave the boat was a source of great grief to Mohammed.
"Very nice temple. All my gentlemen's like to see that temple. I get you carriage. I get you chair and sailors carry you."
Mr. Parker Pine refused all these tempting offers. The others set off. Mr. Parker Pine waited on deck. Presently, the door of Lady Grail's cabin opened, and the lady herself trailed out on deck.
"Such a hot afternoon," she observed. "I see you've stayed behind, Mr. Pine. Very wise of you. Shall we have some tea together in the lounge?"
Mr. Parker Pine rose promptly and followed her. It cannot be denied that he was curious. It seemed as though Lady Grail felt some difficulty in coming to the point. She fluttered from this subject to that. But finally she spoke, in an altered voice.
"Mr. Pine, what I am about to tell you is in the strictest confidence. You do understand that, don't you?"
"Oh, naturally."
She paused, took a deep breath. Mr. Parker Pine waited.
"I want to know whether or not my husband is poisoning me."
Whatever Mr. Parker Pine had expected, it was not this. He showed his astonishment plainly.
"That is a very serious accusation to make, Lady Grail. Well, I'm not a fool, and I wasn't born yesterday. I've had my suspicions for some time. Whenever George goes away, I get better. My food doesn't disagree with me, and I feel a different woman. There must be some reason for that."
"What you say is very serious, Lady Grail. You must remember, I am not a detective. I am, if you like to put it that way, a heart specialist."
She interrupted him.
"Eh? And don't you think it worries me, all this? It is not a policeman I want. I can look after myself, thank you. It's certainty I want. I've got to know. I'm not a wicked woman, Mr. Pine. I act fairly by those who act fairly by me. A bargain's a bargain. I've kept my side of it. I've paid my husband's debts, and I've not stinted him in money."
Mr. Parker Pine had a fleeting pang of pity for Sir George. "And as for the girl, she's had clothes and parties and this and that and the other. Common gratitude is all I ask."
"Gratitude is not a thing that can be produced to order, Lady Grail."
"Nonsense," said Lady Grail.
She went on.
"Well, there it is. Find out the truth for me. Once I know..."
He looked at her curiously.
"Once you know, what then, Lady Grail?"
"That's my business."
Her lips closed sharply. Mr. Parker Pine hesitated a minute. Then he said,
"You will excuse me, Lady Grail, but I have the impression that you are not being entirely frank with me."
"Well, that's absurd. I've told you exactly what I want you to find out."
"Yes, but not the reason why."
Their eyes met. Hers fell first.
"I should think the reason was self-evident," she said.
"No. Because I am in doubt upon one point."
"What is that?"
"Do you want your suspicions proved right or wrong?"
"Really, Mr. Pine?"
The lady rose to her feet, quivering with indignation. Mr. Parker Pine nodded his head gently.
"Yes, yes," he said. "But that doesn't answer my question, you know."
"No!"
Words seemed to fail her. She swept out of the room. Left alone, Mr. Parker Pine became very thoughtful. He was so deep in his own thoughts that he started perceptibly when someone came in and sat down opposite him. It was Miss McNaughton.
"Surely, you're all back very soon," said Mr. Parker Pine.
"The others aren't back. I said I had a headache and came back alone."
She hesitated.
"Where is Lady Grail?" "I should imagine lying down in her cabin."
"Oh, then that's all right. I don't want her to know I've come back."
"You didn't come on her account, then?"
Miss McNaughton shook her head.
"No, I came back to see you."
Mr. Parker Pine was surprised. He would have said offhand that Miss McNaughton was eminently capable of looking after troubles herself, without seeking outside advice. It seemed that he was wrong.
I've watched you since we all came on board. I think you're a person of wide experience and good judgment, and I want advice, very badly.
And yet, excuse me, Miss McNaughton, but you're not the type that usually seeks advice. I should say that you were a person who was quite content to rely on her own judgment.
Normally, yes, but I'm in a very peculiar position. She hesitated a moment. I do not usually talk about my cases, but in this instance, I think it is necessary. Mr. Pine, when I left England with Lady Grail, she was a straightforward case. In plain language, there was nothing the matter with her. Well, that's not quite true, perhaps. Too much leisure and too much money do produce a definite pathological condition. Having a few floors to scrub every day and 5 or 6 children to look after would have made Lady Grail a perfectly healthy and a much happier woman. Mr. Parker Pine nodded. As a hospital nurse, one sees a lot of these nervous cases. Lady Grail enjoyed her bad health. It was my part not to minimize her sufferings, to be as tactful as I could, and to enjoy the trip myself as much as possible.
Very sensible, said Mr. Parker Pine.
Mr. Pine, things are not as they were. The suffering that Lady Grail complains of now is real, and not imagined.
You mean...
I have come to suspect that Lady Grail is being poisoned.
Since when have you suspected this?
For the past 3 weeks.
Do you suspect any particular person?
Her eyes dropped. For the first time, her voice lacked sincerity.
No. I put it to you, Miss McNaughton, that you do suspect one particular person, and that that person is Sir George Grail.
Oh, no, I can't believe it of him. He's so pathetic, so childlike. He couldn't be a cold-blooded poisoner. Her voice had an anguished note in it.
And yet you have noticed that whenever Sir George is absent, his wife is better, and that her periods of illness correspond with his return.
She did not answer.
What poison do you suspect?
Arsenic? Something of that kind.
Arsenic or antimony.
And what steps have you taken? I've done my utmost to supervise what Lady Grail eats and drinks.
Mr. Parker Pine nodded.
Do you think Lady Grail has any suspicion herself?
He asked casually. Oh, no, I'm sure she hasn't.
There, you are wrong, said Mr. Parker Pine. Lady Grail does suspect.
Miss McNaughton showed her astonishment.
Lady Grail is more capable of keeping a secret than you imagine, said Mr. Parker Pine. She is a woman who knows how to keep her own counsel very well.
That surprises me very much, said Miss McNaughton slowly.
I should like to ask you one more question, Miss McNaughton. Do you think Lady Grail likes you?
I've never thought about it. They were interrupted. Mohammed came in, his face beaming, his robes flowing behind him.
A lady, she hear you come back. She asks for you. She say, why have you not come to her?
Elsie McNaughton rose hurriedly. Mr. Parker Pine rose also.
Would a consultation early tomorrow morning suit you? He asked.
Yes, that would be the best time. Lady Grail sleeps late. In the meantime, I shall be very careful.
I think Lady Grail will be careful too.
Miss McNaughton disappeared.
Mr. Parker Pine did not see Lady Grail till just before dinner. She was sitting smoking a cigarette and burning what seemed to be a letter. She took no notice at all of him, by which he gathered that she was still offended. After dinner, he played bridge with Sir George, Pamela, and Basil. Everyone seemed a little distray, and the bridge game broke up early. It was some hours later when Mr. Parker Pine was roused. It was Mohammed who came to him.
Old lady, she very ill. Nurse, she very frightened. I try to get doctor.
Mr. Parker Pine hurried on some clothes. He arrived at the doorway of Lady Grail's cabin at the same time as Basil West. Sir George and Pamela were inside. Elsie McNaughton was working desperately over her patient. As Mr. Parker Pine arrived, a final convulsion seized the poor lady.
Her arched body writhed and stiffened. Then she fell back on her pillows. Mr. Parker Pine drew Pamela gently outside.
How awful!
The girl was half-sobbing.
How awful! Is she...
dead? Yes. I am afraid it is all over. He put her into Basil's keeping. Sir George came out of the cabin looking dazed.
I never thought she was really ill, he was muttering. Never thought it for a moment.
Mr. Parker Pine pushed past him and entered the cabin. Elsie McNaughton's face was white and drawn.
Have they sent for a doctor?
She asked.
Yes.
Then he said, Strychnine?
Yes, those convulsions are unmistakable. Oh, I can't believe it.
She sank into a chair, weeping. He patted her shoulder. Then an idea seemed to strike him. He left the cabin hurriedly and went to the lounge. There was a little scrap of paper, left unburnt in an ashtray. Just a few words were distinguishable. C-H-E-T of dreams. Burn this. Now, that's interesting, said Mr. Parker Pine. Mr. Parker Pine sat in the room of a prominent Cairo official. So, that's the evidence, he said thoughtfully.
Yes, pretty complete. Man must have been a damn fool. I shouldn't call Sir George a brainy man. All the same, the other recapitulated, Lady Grail wants a cup of Bovril. The nurse makes it for her. Then she must have sherry in it. Sir George produces the sherry. 2 hours later, Lady Grail dies with unmistakable signs of strychnine poisoning. A packet of strychnine is found in Sir George's cabin, and another packet actually in the pocket of his dinner jacket.
Very thorough, said Mr. Parker Pine. Where did the strychnine come from, by the way?
Well, there's little doubt over that. The nurse had some, in case Lady Grail's heart troubled her. But she's contradicted herself once or twice. First, she said her supply was intact. Now she says it isn't.
Very unlike her not to be sure, was Mr. Parker Pine's comment.
Well, they were in it together, in my opinion. They've got a weakness for each other, those two.
Possibly. But if Miss McNaughton had been planning murder, she'd have done it a good deal better. She's an efficient young woman.
Well, there it is. In my opinion, Sir George is in for it. He hasn't a dog's chance.
Well, well, said Mr. Parker Pine. I must see what I can do. He sought out the pretty niece. Pamela was white and indignant.
Nunks never did such a thing. Never, never, never.
Well, then, who did? Said Mr. Parker Pine placidly. Pamela came nearer.
Do you know what I think? She did it herself. She's been frightfully queer lately. She used to imagine things.
What things?
Queer things. Basil, for instance. She was always hinting that Basil was in love with her. And Basil and I are... We are...
I realize that, said Mr. Parker Pine, smiling.
All that about Basil was pure imagination. I think she had it down on poor little Nunks. And I think she made up that story and told it to you, and then put the strychnine in his cabin and in his pocket and poisoned herself. People have done things like that, haven't they?
They have, admitted Mr. Parker Pine. But I don't think that Lady Grail did. She wasn't, if you will allow me to say so, the type.
But the delusions?
Yes, I'd like to ask Mr. West about that.
He found the young man in his room. Basil answered his questions quite readily enough.
I don't want to sound fatuous, but she took a fancy to me. That's why I daren't let her know about me and Pamela. She'd have had Sir George fire me.
You think Miss Grail's theory a likely one?
Well, it's possible, I suppose.
The young man was doubtful.
But not good enough, said Mr. Parker Pine quietly.
No, we must find something better. He became lost in meditation for a minute or two.
A confession would be best, he said briskly.
He unscrewed his fountain pen and produced a sheet of paper.
Just write it out, will you?
Mr. Basil West stared at him in amazement.
Me?
What on earth do you mean? My dear young man, Mr. Parker Pine sounded almost paternal, I know all about it. How you made love to the good lady, how she had scruples, how you fell in love with the pretty, penniless niece, how you arranged your plot. Slow poisoning. It might pass for natural death from gastroenteritis. If not, it would be laid to Sir George's doing, since you were careful to let the attacks coincide with his presence. Then you discovered that the lady was suspicious and had talked to me about the matter. Quick action. You abstracted some strychnine from Miss McNaughton's store, planted some of it in Sir George's cabin and some in his pocket, and put sufficient into a cachet which you enclosed with a note to the lady telling her it was a cachet of dreams. A romantic idea. She'd take it as soon as the nurse had left her, and no one would know anything about it. But you made one mistake, my young man. It is useless asking a lady to burn letters. They never do. I've got all that pretty correspondence, including the one about the cachet. Basil West had turned green. All his good looks had vanished. He looked like a trapped rat. Damn you, he snarled. So you know all about it, you damned interfering nosy Parker. Mr. Parker Pine was saved from physical violence by the appearance of the witnesses he had thoughtfully arranged to have listening outside the half-closed door. Mr. Parker Pine was again discussing the case with his friend, the high official. And I hadn't a shred of evidence, only an almost indecipherable fragment with "burn this" on it. I deduced the whole story and tried it on him. It worked. I'd stumbled on the truth. The letters did it. Lady Grail had burned every scrap he wrote, but he didn't know that. She was really a very unusual woman. I was puzzled when she came to me. What she wanted was for me to tell her that her husband was poisoning her. In that case, she meant to go off with young West, but she wanted to act fairly. Curious character. That poor little girl is going to suffer, said the other. Oh, she'll get over it, said Mr. Parker Pine callously. She's young. I'm anxious that Sir George should get a little enjoyment before it's too late. He's been treated like a worm for 10 years. Now Elsie McNaughton will be very kind to him. He beamed. Then he sighed. I am thinking of going incognito to Greece. I really must have a holiday.
Death by Drowning. Sir Henry Clithering, ex-commissioner of Scotland Yard, was staying with his friend the Bantries at their place near the little village of St. Mary Mead. On Saturday morning, coming down to breakfast at the pleasant, guestly hour of 10:15, he almost collided with his hostess, Mrs. Bantry, in the doorway of the breakfast room. She was rushing from the room, evidently in a condition of some excitement and distress. Colonel Bantry was sitting at the table, his face rather redder than usual. "Morning, Clithering," he said. "Nice day. Help yourself." Sir Henry obeyed. As he took his seat, a plate of kidneys and bacon in front of him, his host went on. "Dolly's a bit upset this morning." "Yes, I rather thought so," said Sir Henry mildly. He wondered a little. His hostess was of a placid disposition, little given to moods or excitements. As far as Sir Henry knew, she felt keenly on one subject only, gardening. "Yes," said Colonel Bantry, "a bit of news we got this morning upset her. Girl in the village. Emmett's daughter. Emmett, who keeps the Blue Boar." "Oh, yes, of course." "Yes," said Colonel Bantry thoughtfully. "Pretty girl. Got herself into trouble. Usual story. I've been arguing with Dolly about that. Foolish of me. Women never see sense. Dolly was all up in arms for the girl. You know what women are. Men are brutes, all the rest of it, etc. But it's not so simple as all that, not in these days. Girls know what they're about. Fellow who seduces a girl, not necessarily a villain. 50-50 as often as not. I rather liked young Sanford myself, a young ass, rather than a Don Juan, I should have said. Is it this man Sanford who has got the girl into trouble? So it seems, of course. I don't know anything personally, said the Colonel cautiously. It's all gossip and chat. You know what this place is. As I say, I know nothing, and I'm not like Dolly, leaping to conclusions, flinging accusations all over the place. Damn it all, one ought to be careful in what one says. You know, inquest and all that. Inquest? Colonel Bantry stared. Yes, didn't I tell you? Girl drowned herself. That's what all the pother's about. That's a nasty business, said Sir Henry. Of course it is. Don't like to think of it myself. Poor pretty little devil. Her father's a hard man by all accounts. I suppose she just felt she couldn't face the music. He paused. That's what upset Dolly so. Where did she drown herself? In the river, just below the mill. It runs pretty fast. There's a footpath and a bridge across. They think she threw herself off that. Oh, well, well. Doesn't bear thinking about. And with a portentous rustle, Colonel Bantry opened his newspaper and proceeded to distract his mind from painful matters by an absorption in the newest iniquities of the government. Sir Henry was only mildly interested by the village tragedy. After breakfast, he established himself on a comfortable chair on the lawn, tilted his hat over his eyes, and contemplated life from a peaceful angle. It was about 11:30 when a neat parlourmaid tripped across the lawn. If you please, sir, Miss Marple has called and would like to see you. Miss Marple? Sir Henry sat up and straightened his hat. The name surprised him. He remembered Miss Marple very well. Her gentle, quiet, old maidish ways, her amazing penetration. He remembered a dozen unsolved and hypothetical cases, and how in each case this typical old maid of the village had leapt unerringly to the right solution of the mystery. Sir Henry had a very deep respect for Miss Marple. He wondered what had brought her to see him. Miss Marple was sitting in the drawing-room, very upright as always, a gaily coloured marketing basket of foreign extraction beside her. Her cheeks were rather pink, and she seemed flustered. Oh, Sir Henry, I'm so glad, so fortunate to find you. I just happened to hear that you were staying down here. I do hope that you'll forgive me. This is a great pleasure, said Sir Henry, taking her hand. I'm afraid Mrs. Bantry's out. Yes, said Miss Marple. I saw her talking to Footit, the butcher, as I passed. Henry Footit was run over yesterday. That was his dog. One of those smooth-haired fox terriers, rather stout and quarrelsome, that butchers always seem to have. Yes, said Sir Henry helpfully. I was glad to get her when she wasn't at home, continued Miss Marple, because it was you I wanted to see about this sad affair. Henry Footit, asked Sir Henry, slightly bewildered. Miss Marple threw him a reproachful glance. No, no. Rose Emmett, of course. You've heard? Sir Henry nodded. Bantry was telling me. Very sad. He was a little puzzled. He couldn't conceive why Miss Marple should want to see him about Rose Emmett. Miss Marple sat down again. Sir Henry also sat. When the old lady spoke, her manner had changed. It was grave and had a certain dignity. You may remember, Sir Henry, that on one or two occasions we played what was really a pleasant kind of game, propounding the mysteries and giving solutions. You were kind enough to say that that I didn't do too badly. You beat us all, said Sir Henry warmly. You displayed an absolute genius for getting to the truth. And you always instanced, I remember, some village parallel which had supplied you with the clue. He smiled as he spoke, but Miss Marple did not smile. She remained very grave. What you have said has emboldened me to come to you now. I feel that if I say something to you, at least you will not laugh at me. He realized suddenly that she was in deadly earnest. Certainly. I won't laugh, he said gently. Sir Henry, this girl, Rose Emmett, she did not drown herself. She was murdered, and I know who murdered her. Sir Henry was silent with sheer astonishment for quite 3 seconds. Miss Marple's voice had been perfectly quiet and unexcited. She might have been making the most ordinary statement in the world for all the emotion she showed. That is a very serious statement to make, Miss Marple, said Sir Henry when he recovered his breath. She nodded her head gently several times. I know, I know. That is why I've come to you. But, my dear lady, I'm not the person to come to. I'm merely a private individual nowadays. If you have knowledge of the kind you claim, you must go to the police. I don't think I can do that, said Miss Marple. Why not? Because, you see, I haven't got any, what you call, knowledge. You mean it's only a guess on your part? You can call it that if you like, but it's not really that at all. I know. I'm in a position to know, but if I gave my reasons for knowing to Inspector Druitt, well, he'd simply laugh, and really, I don't know that I'd blame him. It's very difficult to understand what you might call specialized knowledge. Such as, suggested Sir Henry. Miss Marple smiled a little. If I were to tell you that I know because of a man called Peasgood leaving turnips instead of carrots when he came round with a cart and sold vegetables to my niece several years ago. She stopped eloquently. A very appropriate name for the trade, murmured Sir Henry. You mean that you are simply judging from the facts in a parallel case? I know human nature, said Miss Marple. It's impossible not to know human nature living in a village all these years. The question is, do you believe me, or don't you? She looked at him very straight. The pink flush had heightened on her cheeks. Her eyes met his steadily without wavering. Sir Henry was a man with a very vast experience of life. He made his decisions quickly without beating about the bush. Unlikely and fantastic as Miss Marple's statement might seem, he was instantly aware that he accepted it. I do believe you, Miss Marple, but I do not see what you want me to do in the matter, or why you've come to me. I have thought and thought about it, said Miss Marple. As I said, it would be useless going to the police without any facts. I have no facts. What I would ask you to do is to interest yourself in the matter. Inspector Druitt would be most flattered, I'm sure, and of course, if the matter went farther, Colonel Melchett, the chief constable, I'm sure, would be wax in your hands. She looked at him appealingly. What data are you going to give me to work upon? I thought, said Miss Marple, of writing a name, the name, on a piece of paper and giving it to you. Then, if on investigation you decide that the person is not involved in any way, well, I shall have been quite wrong. She paused and then added with a slight shiver, oh, it would be so dreadful, so very dreadful, if an innocent person were to be hanged. What on earth? Cried Sir Henry, startled. She turned a distressed face upon him. I may be wrong about that, though I don't think so. Inspector Druitt, you see, is really an intelligent man, but a mediocre amount of intelligence is sometimes most dangerous. Doesn't take one far enough. Sir Henry looked at her curiously. Fumbling a little, Miss Marple opened a small reticule. She took out a little notebook, tore out a leaf, carefully wrote a name on it, and folding it in two, handed it to Sir Henry. He opened it and read the name. It conveyed nothing to him, but his eyebrows lifted a little. He looked across at Miss Marple and tucked the piece of paper in his pocket. Well, well, he said, rather an extraordinary business, this. I've never done anything like it before. But I'm going to back my judgment of you, Miss Marple. Sir Henry was sitting in a room with Colonel Melchett, the chief constable of the county, and Inspector Druitt. The chief constable was a little man of aggressively military demeanour. The inspector was big and broad and eminently sensible. I really do feel I'm butting in, said Sir Henry with a pleasant smile. I can't really tell you why I'm doing it. Strict truth is. My dear fellow, we're charmed. It's a great compliment. Honoured, Sir Henry, said the inspector. The chief constable was thinking, bored to death, poor old fellow at the Bantries. The old man abusing the government and the old woman babbling on about bulbs. The inspector was thinking, pity we're not up against a real teaser. One of the best brains in England, I've heard it said. Pity it's all such plain sailing. Aloud, the chief constable said, I'm afraid it's all very sordid and straightforward. First idea was that the girl had pitched herself in. She was in the family way, you understand. However, Our doctor, Haydock, is a careful fellow. He noticed the bruises on each arm, upper arm, caused before death. Just where a fellow would have taken her by the arms and flung her in. Would that require much strength? I think not. There'd be no struggle. The girl would be taken unawares. It's a footbridge of slippery wood, easiest thing in the world to pitch her over. There's no handrail on that side. You know for a fact that the tragedy occurred there? Yes, we've got a boy, Jimmy Brown, aged 12. He was in the woods on the other side. He heard a kind of scream from the bridge and a splash. It was dusk, you know, difficult to see anything. Presently he saw something white floating down in the water and he ran and got help. They got her out, but it was too late to revive her. Sir Henry nodded. The boy saw no one on the bridge? No, but as I tell you, it was dusk and there's a mist always hanging about there. I'm going to question him as to whether he saw anyone about just afterwards or just before. You see, he naturally assumed that the girl had thrown herself over. Everybody did to start with. Still, we've got the note, said Inspector Druitt. He turned to Sir Henry. Note in the dead girl's pocket, sir, written with a kind of artist's pencil it was. And all of a sop though the paper was, we managed to read it. And what did it say? It was from young Sanford. All right, that's how it ran. I'll meet you at the bridge at 8:30, R.S. Well, it was as near as might be to 8:30, a few minutes after, when Jimmy Brown heard the cry and the splash. I don't know whether you've met Sanford at all, went on Colonel Melchett. He's been down here about a month, one of those modern-day young architects who build peculiar houses, doing a house for Allington. God knows what it's going to be like. Full of newfangled stuff, I suppose. Glass dinner table and surgical chairs made of steel and webbing. Well, that's neither here nor there, but it shows the kind of chap Sanford is. Bolshy, you know, no morals. Seduction, said Sir Henry mildly, is quite an old, established crime, though it does not, of course, date back so far as murder. Colonel Melchett stared. Oh, yes, he said, quite, quite. Well, Sir Henry, said Druitt, there it is. An ugly business, but plain. This young Sanford gets the girl into trouble, then he's all for clearing off back to London. He's got a girl there, a nice young lady, he's engaged to be married to her. Well, naturally, this business, if she gets to hear of it, may cook his goose good and proper. He meets Rose at the bridge, missed the evening, no one about. He catches her by the shoulders and pitches her in. Proper young swine, and deserves what's coming to him, that's my opinion. Sir Henry was silent for a minute or two. He perceived a strong undercurrent of local prejudice. A newfangled architect was not likely to be popular in the conservative village of St. Mary Mead. There's no doubt, I suppose, that this man Sanford was actually the father of the coming child, he asked. He's the father, all right, said Druitt. Rose Emmett let out as much to her father. She thought he'd marry her. Marry her, not he. Yeah, me, thought Sir Henry, I seem to be back in mid-Victorian melodrama. Unsuspecting girl, the villain from London, the stern father, the betrayal. We only need the faithful village lover. Yes, I think it's time I asked about him. And aloud he said, hadn't the girl a young man of her own down here? You mean Joe Ellis, said the inspector. Good fellow, Joe. Carpentering's his trade. Ah, she's stuck to Joe. Colonel Melchett nodded approval. Stick to your own class, he snapped. How did Joe Ellis take this affair, asked Sir Henry. Nobody knew how he was taking it, said the inspector. He's a quiet fellow, is Joe. Close. Anything Rose did was right in his eyes. She had him on her string all right. Just hoped she'd come back to him some day. That was his attitude, I reckon. I'd like to see him, said Sir Henry. Oh, we're going to look him up, said Colonel Melchett. We're not neglecting any line. I thought myself we'd see Emmett first, then Sanford. And then we can go on and see Ellis. That suit you, Clithering? Sir Henry said it would suit him admirably. They found Tom Emmett at the Blue Boar. He was a big, burly man of middle age, with a shifty eye and truculent jaw. Glad to see you, gentlemen. Good morning, Colonel. Come in here, we'll be private. Can I offer you anything, gentlemen? No? It's as you please. you come about this business of my poor girl? Ah, she was a good girl, Rose was. Always was a good girl. Well, this bloody swine, beg pardon, but that's what he is, till he came along. Promised her marriage, he did. But I'll have the law of him. Drove her to it, he did, murdering swine, bringing disgrace on all of us. My poor girl. Your daughter distinctly told you that Mr. Stanford was responsible for her condition? Asked Melchett crisply. She did, in this very room she did. And what did you say to her? Asked Sir Henry. Say to her? The man seemed momentarily taken aback. Yes, you didn't, for example, threaten to turn her out of the house. I was a bit upset. That's only natural. I'm sure you'll agree that's only natural, but of course I didn't turn her out of the house. I wouldn't do such a thing. He assumed virtuous indignation. No, what's the law for? That's what I say. What's the law for? He got to do the right thing by her, and if he didn't, by God, he's got to pay. He brought down his fist on the table. What time did you last see your daughter? Asked Melchett. Yesterday, tea time. What was her manner then? Well, much as usual, I didn't notice anything. If I'd known... But you didn't know, said the inspector dryly. They took their leave. Emmett hardly creates a favourable impression, said Sir Henry thoughtfully. Bit of a blackguard, said Melchett. He'd have bled Stanford all right if he'd had the chance. Their next call was on the architect. Rex Sanford was very unlike the picture Sir Henry had unconsciously formed of him. He was a tall young man, very fair and very thin. His eyes were blue and dreamy, his hair was untidy and rather too long. His speech was a little too ladylike. Colonel Melchett introduced himself and his companions. Then, passing straight to the object of his visit, he invited the architect to make a statement as to his movements on the previous evening. You understand, he said warningly, I have no power to compel a statement from you, and any statement you make may be used in evidence against you. I want the position to be quite clear to you. I don't understand, said Sanford. You understand that the girl Rose Emmett was drowned last night? I know. Oh, it's too distressing, really. I haven't slept a wink. I've been incapable of any work today. I feel responsible, terribly responsible. He ran his hands through his hair, making it untidier still. I never meant any harm, he said piteously. I never thought, I never dreamt she'd take it in that way. He sat down at a table and buried his face in his hands. Do I understand you to say, Mr. Sanford, that you refused to make a statement as to where you were last night at 8:30? No, certainly not. I was out. I went for a walk. You went to meet Miss Emmett? No, I went by myself through the woods, a long way. Then how do you account for this note, sir, which was found in the dead girl's pocket? And the inspector drew it, read it aloud, without emotion. Now, sir, he finished. You deny that you wrote that? No, you're right, I did write it. Rose asked me to meet her. She insisted. I didn't know what to do, so I wrote that note. Ah, that's better, said the inspector. But I didn't go. Sanford's voice rose high and excited. I didn't go. I felt it would be much better not. I was returning to town tomorrow. I felt it would be much better not to meet. I intended to write from London and make some arrangement. You're aware, sir, that this girl was going to have a child and that she had named you as its father? Sanford groaned, but didn't answer. Was that statement true, sir? Sanford buried his face deeper. I suppose so, he said in a muffled voice. Ah, Inspector Druitt could not disguise his satisfaction. Now, about this walk of yours, is there anyone who saw you last night? I don't know. I don't think so. As far as I can remember, I didn't meet anybody. That's a pity. What do you mean? Sanford stared wildly at him. What does it matter whether I was out for a walk or not? What difference does that make to Rose drowning herself? Ah, said the inspector, but you see, she didn't. She was thrown in deliberately, Mr. Sanford. She was... It took him a minute or two to take in all the horror of it. My God! Then he dropped into a chair. Colonel Melchett made a move to depart. You understand, Sanford, he said. You're on no account to leave this house. The three men left together. The inspector and the chief constable exchanged glances. That's enough, I think, sir, said the inspector. Yes, get a warrant made out and arrest him. Excuse me, said Sir Henry, I've forgotten my gloves. He re-entered the house rapidly. Sanford was sitting just as they left him, staring dazedly in front of him. I have come back, said Sir Henry, to tell you that I personally am anxious to do all I can to assist you. The motive of my interest in you I am not at liberty to reveal, but I am going to ask you, if you will, to tell me as briefly as possible exactly what passed between you and this girl Rose. She was very pretty, said Sanford, very pretty and very alluring, and she made a dead set for me. Oh, before God, that's true. She wouldn't let me alone. And it was lonely down here, and nobody liked me much, and as I say, she was amazingly pretty, and she seemed to know her way about, and all that. His voice died away. He looked up. And then this happened. She wanted me to marry her. I didn't know what to do. I'm engaged to a girl in London. Oh, she ever gets to hear of this, and she will, of course. But it's all up. She won't understand. How could she? And I am a rotter, of course. As I say, I didn't know what to do. I avoided seeing Rose again. I thought I'd get back to town, see my lawyer, make arrangements about money and so forth for her. Oh, God, what a fool I've been. And it's all so clear, the case against me. But they've made a mistake. She must have done it herself. Did she ever threaten to take her life? Sanford shook his head. Never. I shouldn't have said she was that sort. What about a man called Joe Ellis? A carpenter fellow, good old village stock. Dull fellow, but crazy about Rose. He might have been jealous, suggested Sir Henry. I suppose he was a bit, but he's a bovine kind. He'd suffer in silence. Well, said Sir Henry, I must be going. He rejoined the others. You know, Melchett, he said, I feel we ought to have a look at this other fellow. Ellis, before we do anything drastic. Pity if you made an arrest that turned out to be a mistake. After all, jealousy is a pretty good motive for murder. Pretty common one, too. That's true enough, said the inspector, but Joe Ellis isn't that kind. Wouldn't hurt a fly. Why, nobody's ever seen him out of temper. Still, I agree, we'd better just ask him where he was last night. He'll be at home now. He lodges with Mrs. Bartlett, very decent soul, a widow, takes in a bit of washing. The little cottage to which they bent their footsteps was spotlessly clean and neat. A big, stout woman of middle age opened the door to them. She had a pleasant face and blue eyes. "Morning, Mrs. Bartlett," said the inspector. "Is Joe Ellis here?" "Came back not 10 minutes ago," said Mrs. Bartlett. "Step inside, will you please, sirs?" Wiping her hands on her apron, she led them into a tiny front parlour with stuffed birds, china dogs, a sofa, and several useless pieces of furniture. She hurriedly arranged seats for them, picked up a whatnot bodily to make further room, and went out calling, "Joe, there's three gentlemen want to see you." A voice from the back kitchen replied, "I'll be there when I've cleaned myself." Mrs. Bartlett smiled. "Come in, Mrs. Bartlett," said Colonel Milchiff. "Sit down." "Oh, no, sir, I couldn't think of it." Mrs. Bartlett was shocked at the idea. "You find Joe Ellis a good lodger?" inquired Milchett in a seemingly careless tone. "Couldn't have a better, sir. Real steady young fellow, never touches a drop of drink, takes a pride in his work, and always kind and helpful about the house. He put up those shelves for me, and he's fixed a new dresser in the kitchen. And any little thing that wants doing in the house, why, Joe does it as a matter of course and won't hardly take thanks for it. Ah, there aren't many young fellows like Joe, sir." "Some girl'll be luckier some day," said Melchett carelessly. "He was rather sweet on that poor girl, Rose Emmett, wasn't he?" Mrs. Bartlett sighed. "Made me tired, it did, him worshipping the ground she trod on and her not caring a snap of the fingers for him. Where does Joe spend his evenings, Mrs. Bartlett?" "Here, sir, usually. Does some odd piece of work in the evening sometimes, and he's trying to learn bookkeeping by correspondence." "Oh, really? Was he in yesterday evening? Yes, sir. You're sure, Mrs. Bartlett, said Sir Henry sharply. She turned to him. Quite sure, sir. He didn't go out, for instance, somewhere about 8 to 8:30. Oh, no, Mrs. Bartlett laughed. He was fixing the kitchen dresser for me nearly all the evening, and I was helping him. Sir Henry looked at her smiling, assured face, and felt his first pang of doubt. A moment later, Ellis himself entered the room. He was a tall, broad-shouldered young man, very good-looking in a rustic way. He had shy blue eyes and a good-tempered smile. Altogether an amiable young giant. Milchard opened the conversation. Mrs. Bartlett withdrew to the kitchen. We're investigating the death of Rose Emmett. You knew her, Ellis? Yes, he hesitated and then muttered. Hope to marry her one day, poor lass. You've heard what her condition was. Yes, a spark of anger showed in his eye. Let her down, he did, but to her for the best. She wouldn't have been happy married to him. I reckon she'd come to me when this happened. I'd have looked after her. In spite of... 'Twan't her fault, he led her astray with fine promises and all. Oh, she told me all about it. She'd no call to drown herself. It weren't worth it. Where were you, Ellis, last night at 8:30? Was it Sir Henry's fancy, or was there really a shade of constraint in the ready, almost too ready, reply? I was here, fixing up a contraption in the kitchen for Mrs. B. You ask her, she'll tell you. He was too quick with that, thought Sir Henry. He's a slow-thinking man. That popped out so pat. I suspect he'd got it ready beforehand. Then he told himself that it was imagination. He was imagining things. Yes, even imagining an apprehensive glint in those blue eyes. A few more questions and answers, and they left. Sir Henry made an excuse to go to the kitchen. Mrs. Bartlett was busy at the stove. She looked up with a pleasant smile. A new dresser was fixed against the wall. It was not quite finished. Some tools lay about and some pieces of wood. That's what Ellis was at work on last night, said Sir Henry. Yes, sir. Nice bit of work, isn't it? He's a very clever carpenter, Joe is. No apprehensive gleam in her eye, no embarrassment. But Ellis, had he imagined it? No, there had been something. I must tackle him, thought Sir Henry. Turning to leave the kitchen, he collided with a perambulator. Not woken the baby up, I hope, he said. Mrs. Bartlett's laugh rang out. Oh, no, sir! I've no children, more's the pity. That's what I take the laundry on, sir. Oh, I see. He paused and said on an impulse, Mrs. Bartlett, you knew Rose Emmett. Tell me what you really thought of her. She looked at him curiously. Well, sir, I thought she was flighty. She's dead, and I don't like to speak ill of the dead. But I have a reason, a very good reason for asking. He spoke persuasively. She seemed to consider, studying him attentively. Finally, she made up her mind. It was a bad lot, sir, she said quietly. I wouldn't say so before Joe. She took him in good and proper. That kind can. More's a pity. You know how it is, sir. Yes, Sir Henry knew. The Joe Ellises of the world were peculiarly vulnerable. They trusted blindly. But for that very cause, the shock of discovery might be greater. He left the cottage baffled and perplexed. He was up against a blank wall. Joe Ellis had been working indoors all yesterday evening. Mrs. Bartlett had actually been there watching him. Could one possibly get round that? There was nothing to set against it, except possibly that suspicious readiness in replying on Joe Ellis's part, that suggestion of having a story, pat. Well, said Milchard, that seems to make the matter quite clear, eh? Does, sir, agreed the inspector. Sanford's our man, not a leg to stand upon. Things as plain as daylight. My opinion is the girl and her father were out to, well, practically blackmail him. He's no money to speak of. He didn't want the matter to get to his young lady's ears. He was desperate, and he acted accordingly. What do you say, sir? He added, addressing Sir Henry deferentially. Seems so, admitted Sir Henry, and yet I can hardly picture Sanford committing any violent action. But he knew as he spoke that the objection was hardly valid. The meekest animal, when cornered, is capable of amazing actions. I should like to see the boy, though, he said suddenly, the one who heard the cry. Jimmy Brown proved to be an intelligent lad, rather small for his age, with a sharp, rather cunning face. He was eager to be questioned and was rather disappointed when checked in his dramatic tale of what he had heard on the fatal night. You were on the other side of the bridge, I understand, said Sir Henry, across the river from the village. Did you see anyone on that side as you came up over the bridge? There was someone walking up in the woods, Mr. Sanford, I think it was, the architect gentleman who was building the queer house. The three men exchanged glances. That was about 10 minutes or so before you heard the cry. The boy nodded. Did you see anyone else on the village side of the river? A man came along the path that side, going slow, and whistling he was. Might have been Joe Ellis. You couldn't possibly have seen who it was, said the inspector sharply, what with the mist and its being dusk. It's on account of the whistle, said the boy. Joe Ellis always whistles the same tune. I want to be happy. The only tune he knows. He spoke with the scorn of the modernist for the old-fashioned. Anyone might whistle a tune, said Melchett. Was he going towards the bridge? No, other way, to village. I don't think we need concern ourselves with this unknown man, said Melchett. You heard the cry and the splash, and a few minutes later you saw the body floating downstream, and you ran for help, going back to the bridge, crossing it, and making straight for the village. You didn't see anyone near the bridge as you ran for help? I think as there were two men with a wheelbarrow on the river path, but they were some ways away, and I couldn't tell if they were coming or going, and Mr. Giles' place was nearest, so I ran there. You did well, my boy, said Melchett. You acted very creditably and with presence of mind. You're a scout, aren't you? Yes, sir. Very good indeed. Sir Henry was silent, thinking. He took a slip of paper from his pocket, looked at it, shook his head. It didn't seem possible. And yet... he decided to pay a call on Miss Marple. She received him in her pretty, slightly overcrowded old-style drawing-room. I've come to report progress, said Sir Henry. I'm afraid that from our point of view, things aren't going well. They're going to arrest Sanford, and I must say I think they're justified. You found nothing in, what shall I say, support of my theory, then? She looked perplexed, anxious. Perhaps I've been wrong, quite wrong. You have such a wide experience. You would surely detect if it were so. One thing, said Sir Henry, I can hardly believe it. And for another, we're up against an unbreakable alibi. Joe Ellis was fixing shelves in the kitchen all the evening, and Mrs. Bartlett was watching him do it. Miss Marple leant forward, taking in a quick breath. Oh, but that can't be so, she said. It was Friday night. Friday night? Yes, Friday night. On Friday evenings, Mrs. Bartlett takes the laundry she has done round to the different people. Sir Henry leant back in his chair. He remembered the boy Jimmy's story of the whistling man, and, yes, it would all fit in. He rose, taking Miss Marple warmly by the hand. I think I see my way, he said. Least I can try. 5 minutes later, he was back at Mrs. Bartlett's cottage and facing Joe Ellis and the little parlour among the china dogs. You lied to us, Ellis, about last night, he said crisply. You were not in the kitchen here fixing the dresser between 8 and 8:30. You were seen walking along the path by the river towards the bridge a few minutes before Rose Emmett was murdered. The man gasped. She weren't murdered. She weren't. I nought to do with it. She threw herself in. She did. She was desperate-like. I wouldn't have harmed her hair and her head. I wouldn't. Then why did you lie as to where you were? Asked Sir Henry keenly. The man's eyes shifted and lowered uncomfortably. I was scared. Mrs. B. saw me around there, and when we heard just after us what had happened, well, she thought it might look bad for me. I fixed I'd say I was working here, and she agreed to back me up. She's a rare one, she is. She's always been good to me. Without a word, Sir Henry left the room and walked into the kitchen. Mrs. Bartlett was washing up at the sink. Mrs. Bartlett, he said, I know everything. I think you'd better confess. That is, unless you want Joe Ellis hanged for something he didn't do. No, I see you don't want that. I'll tell you what happened. You were out taking the laundry home. You came across Rose Emmett. You thought she'd given Joe the chuck and was taking up with this stranger. Now she was in trouble. Joe was prepared to come to the rescue, marry her if need be, and if she'd have him. He's lived in your house for 4 years. You've fallen in love with him. You want him for yourself. You hated this girl. You couldn't bear that this worthless little slut should take your man from you. You're a strong woman, Mrs. Bartlett. You caught the girl by the shoulders and shoved her over into the stream. A few minutes later, you met Joe Ellis. The boy Jimmy saw you together in the distance. But in the darkness and the mist, he assumed the perambulator was a wheelbarrow and two men wheeling it. You persuaded Joe that he might be suspected, and you concocted what was supposed to be an alibi for him, but which was really an alibi for you. Now then, I'm right, am I not? He held his breath. He'd staked all on this throw. She stood before him, rubbing her hands on her apron, slowly making up her mind. It's just as you say, sir, she said at last in her quiet, subdued voice. A dangerous voice, Sir Henry suddenly felt it to be. I don't know what came over me. Shameless. That's what she was. It just came over me. She shan't take Joe from me. I haven't had a happy life, sir. My husband, he was a poor lot. An invalid and cross-grained. I nursed and looked after him, true. And then Joe came here to lodge. I'm not such an old woman, sir, in spite of my grey hair. I'm just 40, sir. Joe's 1 in 1,000. I'd have done anything for him, anything at all. He was like a little child, sir, so gentle and so believing. He was mine, sir, to look after and see to, and this... She swallowed, checked her emotion. Even at this moment she was a strong woman. She stood up straight and looked at Sir Henry curiously. I'm ready to come, sir. I never thought anyone would find out. I don't know how you knew, sir. I don't, I'm sure. Sir Henry shook his head gently. It was not I who knew, he said. And he thought of the piece of paper still reposing in his pocket, with the words on it written in neat old-fashioned handwriting. Mrs. Bartlett, with whom Joe Ellis lodges at 2 Mill Cottages. Miss Marple had been right again.